You know, you think of Venice and you think of the carnival mask, right? People are kind of anonymously going to these masquerades. What I didn't know was that they wore these masks in the 18th century almost year-round, and not just to parties, but to buy fish at the market, to go to work.
That's Lauren Kate, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Lauren Kate is the number one New York Times and internationally best-selling author of 9 novels for young adults, including Fallen, which was made into a major motion picture by Sony. Her books have been translated into more than 30 languages and have sold more than 10 million copies worldwide. She joins us to talk about her latest novel, The Orphan Song. Lauren, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Dan.
This novel, was there a particular inspiration for it?
I was in Venice on a book tour for another novel, and I got lost on my way home from an event. And I found myself before this hulking stone structure called the Hospital of the Incurables. And the name stood out to me. I wanted to know who these incurables were and what this hospital was about. I did a little bit of research, and everything I found out led me deeper and deeper into this world. In the 15th century in Venice, this hospital was founded as an orphanage for children who were trained to sing and play instruments for the church. And for 500 years, it was the world's original music conservatory. And somehow, by the 18th century, which is when my novel is set, these young foundling girls had become the most famous musicians of their day. They were rock stars, in a way, and people would travel from all over the world to see and hear them. I was just fascinated by the idea that all of them were foundlings. None of them had families. So there were probably a lot of heartbreaking stories within, you know, their experience. And then that they were asked to sign an oath when they joined the choir that basically signed their lives away to the church. They were never allowed to sing or play outside the walls of the orphanage and the church. So it was both a very celebrated life for them to become so famous and also an extremely restricted life. So, of course, I'm thinking about the little rebel who would become my heroine, who would dream of more and need to break out from the confines of this life.
So tell us more about the plot of The Orphan Song.
So, I mean, it's a very interesting era this time in Venice. It's extremely decadent. Something that I didn't realize was that, you know, you think of Venice and you think of the carnival mask, right? People are kind of anonymously going to these masquerades. What I didn't know was that they wore these masks in the 18th century almost year-round, and not just to parties, but to buy fish at the market, to go to work. Senators went to cast their votes wearing masks so that no one would know who they were, what they were voting for. And just that idea of anonymity being kind of the ruling force of the day, it made me wonder a lot about what that would do to people's ideas of themselves and ideas of identity. And I was thinking about the kind of masks that we wear today with, you know, social media putting one face forward and another face, you know, is who we maybe really are. So Violetta, as she breaks free of the orphanage, once she rises to power, she begins a kind of masked and anonymous secret nighttime life that leads her to and then away from the character Mino, who is the male protagonist in the story. The story is told from alternating points of view. Violetta gets a chapter and then Mino gets a chapter. And as the book goes along and the tension between them escalates, the chapters I found got shorter and shorter because the characters were just in such a hurry to get back to the other side of the story until the very kind of final crescendo chapter where they finally reunite, that the structure of those alternating chapters dissolves and they both tell the same story simultaneously.
Well, since you were alternating between the perspectives of your two protagonists, what kind of challenge did that present for you as an author?
You know, it is difficult to switch gears like that and tell one story that you get so invested in. This is the voice and this is the experience, and then, you know, start a new chapter and, you know, you're leaving that character and going into another mind and heart and soul. I think what made this book easier, because I have done other alternating points of views in other books before, and what made this one possible was the intense connection between the two of them and the love between them that was propelling them back toward each other. It felt like there was a force that existed between these two that, I don't know, when I switched gears each time, I felt that they were drawing closer to each other. And there was something about that, and there was something about each of their drives to find the other one that felt almost like an invisible string between the two narrations.
You mentioned earlier that they essentially had to sign their lives away to enjoy this life of music. So in addition to not being able to perform outside of the orphanage, was this relationship that your two characters pursued also forbidden?
Yes, absolutely. The two wings of the orphanage, they were completely separate, one for the boys and one for the girls. And so these characters, though they had grown up under the same roof, you know, for by the time they meet, they're 16 years old, they had never even seen each other before. They had different dormitories, different nurseries, different dining halls. They were kept completely separate, and any interaction between them was absolutely forbidden, which, of course, makes it so much more delicious. When they finally meet, both of them have snuck up to this forbidden rooftop where they're not supposed to be and found the other one. Then what amazes them both is that Mino, the main character, the male, he's a violinist, and he begins to play a song that he believes he has made up, that he believes he has composed himself. And it's very different from the sacred music that they perform and sing in the church. This is secular music. Sounds nothing like any of the other music that they hear. And the amazing thing to Violetta is that she knows this song. Not only does she know it, but she believes she made it up. She believes it's her song. And so there's a memory between the two of them that is much older than their relationship, and that goes back to very early on in both their childhoods, that connects them. And so the mystery of that song's origins and what it means to each of them is the driving mystery of the story that they're trying to figure out.
In this story, obviously your protagonists are people that you created for the novel, but you also mix in some people that actually did exist during that time.
Yes. I mean, the main historical figures that are true to the world are the maestros. So this is an era when Vivaldi was becoming famous, and he was actually teaching in one of, not the orphanage where this book is set, but he was teaching at sort of their rival conservatory across the canal. And the maestros that taught at the Incurables, the one who's in this book is named Nicholas Porpora. He was a real maestro who really taught these young girls. The girls, I mean, in the archives when I went to Venice and pored over the documents that they still have from these hospitals, the girls were still quite anonymous. I mean, they didn't even have last names. They were known by their first name and then the instrument that they were best at. So they would be Laura of the violin, or Angela of the oboe, or in this case, Violetta. The singers were called, you know, Violetta of the angel's voice. So I thought that that was very, I don't know, it felt really poignant to me that their identities were kind of reduced to that, and their stories were just contained in those few words by their name and their instrument. You know, that was the space I wanted to push at and find the true heart of.
So, as you mentioned, your characters rebel on several different levels. Obviously, there's the romantic relationship, but they're breaking away from those bonds that they were placed in and breaking free of those expectations. Tell us a little bit more about that and how you think that relates to what's happening in today's world.
I write a lot of different kind of stories. I've written, you know, this is obviously historical fiction. I've also written speculative fantasy and science fiction and realistic contemporary fiction. But the through line in my work tends to be about the transformative power of love and how it changes us and pushes us to become more of who we always wanted to be. Even when it's not a good love story, I think we can always learn something very essential about ourselves from romantic relationships. So, you know, in this case, in really all fiction, like, I had to stack the deck against these characters and give them all sorts of boundaries and forbidden aspects to their relationship and then see how they would rise to overcome them. So, you know, I think that love is a kind of time machine, and it's a way of both humanizing the past and of humanizing historical figures. If you can really get inside their emotional situations and feel the love that they might have felt, I think you can always connect with a character that way, whether or not they're set in Iowa in 2019 or in Venice in 1737.
You mentioned earlier the research that you had to do for this novel. The Hospital of the Incurables was a music conservatory, but I understand it has returned to that purpose as well.
Yeah, it's now a fine arts college. So when I went back to visit it and, you know, kind of walked its hallways, it's still filled with young people making art, the painters and graphic designers and musicians as well. I think it's interesting that it has become such a different place. It's now really a place of freedom where people go, leave their families and go to study their art versus kind of being bound there by accidental and unfortunate circumstances. You know, Venice in general really wears its history on its sleeve. It's not that hard to find yourself lost, you know, turning the wrong corner in some narrow alley, and you're not only not on the street you meant to be on, but you're not in the time you meant to be in. You can really step backwards and imagine what it was like for people back hundreds of years ago.
There's a question that I like to ask authors of fiction, and it's this. If you could spend a day with one of the characters you created for this novel, who would it be and why?
That's such a great question. I mean, I would have to say Violetta. I think, and surprisingly in some ways, I do spend my days with her because she is inspired by my daughter's character and some of the aspects of my daughter's personality. And there's a fierceness to Violetta's pursuit of the things that she wants in life that leads to an immense amount of creativity and focus that I really admire, and my daughter shares that. So I think, you know, somebody who is really talented and good at one thing but refuses to be pigeonholed there and sees a much bigger life for herself even than everybody who is supporting her sees for her, and a real need to carve out a different kind of space for herself. Yeah, it's inspiring to be around it.
The book is called The Orphan Song. It's by Lauren Kate. Lauren, what's next for you?
Oh, I am currently working on a new novel, also historical fiction. It's about three prostitutes solving a mystery on the front lines of the Civil War.
Lauren, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Lauren Kate's latest novel is The Orphan Song. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. You can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes, and you'll also find us on Facebook. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.